Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins on the local news roundup. A geyser of water disrupts service across the city. A boil water advisory is issued and then later rescinded. A look at what happened. Redistricting continues at all levels across the state. This week, the CMS school board begins the process. City Council holds a public hearing on their new maps and gets an earful. And vaccines are coming for children age 5 to 11, even as COVID-related staff shortages create challenges for schools. Here to bring us up to date on those stories and more is WFAE's education reporter Ann Doss Helms. Good morning to you. Welcome.
Good morning from Belmont, where the water pressure has been lovely all week.
Well, good for you. Joe Bruno. Joe Bruno, a geyser unto himself, is a reporter for WSOC TV Channel 9. Good morning to you. Welcome back.
Good morning from Plaza Midwood, where we did not have water.
Really? Still?
No, you did not have water.
Katie Peralta-Soloff is a reporter for Axios Charlotte. An update from you, Katie.
Good morning. Here in NOTA, we had low pressure, so we decided to boil all of our water as well, which was fun.
And Mary C. Curtis is here, a columnist for RollCall.com and the host of their Equal Time podcast. In the interest of equal time, how's your water doing, Mary?
From Myers Park, we don't think there's ever a problem, but I boiled it to brush my teeth anyway. Good morning.
Good morning. Well, we have clearly begun with Charlotte's version of Old Faithful, so let's continue along that watery path through the eyes of Charlotte resident Julian Holland, who posted his experience on Twitter.
Don't see this every day.
He's driving
what's
down the road.
What's going on? Look at that rainbow. Ooh. But what is that? Let me go before this thing erupts.
Yes, that's the sound of the geyser at Remount Road. His reaction also to the water main break there near Revolution Park, which sent water higher than the treetops.
As I'm approaching it, like I said, it just looked like something that you would see in a movie, something that, you know, when they say the dam burst and you see all of that water shooting out, it was just like that.
Katrina Giles talking to the Charlotte Observer. She was driving on Remount Road on Monday afternoon when the water shot up in the air not far from her car. So what happened, everybody? We know a water main broke. What's the deal?
Joe? No, we don't really know why. Okay. The pipe burst. It's an old pipe. It's a 66-year-old pipe. So it's possible that old age and it just gave out. But it was a mess to clean up and to tell the public about the incident. But we still don't know why it actually burst.
So this has been described as an historic water main break. Why is it historic? What gives it that appellation?
I think the size and scope of the problem and how many people were impacted and were told to boil water make water main break historic. It was also a transmission line. So unlike most water main breaks that we never talk about on this program because they impact like a neighborhood, this one impacted the entire city because this is where this pipe, you know, feeds the water out to the entire city. Yeah. Does that make sense how I'm explaining it?
Yeah, this takes it from the pumping station to where it branches out to cover most of the city. And most of the city proper lost water pressure or had a problem with water because of it. It actually surprised me that this pipe was only 36 inches in diameter. That's a yard. That sounds big, but not when you consider that it's a feeder to the entire city, evidently, because NoDa was affected, Plaza Mid was affected, and that's on Remount Road, way far away from those neighborhoods. Charlotte Water Director Angela Charles says the pipe that broke was 66 years old.
It will be a difficult repair. It's a 36-inch pipe, 15 feet under the creek bed.
And she also said that as workers repair that section, they'll also be looking at other sections. 66 years old means the pipe was put in 1955. How does that compare with other older pieces of Charlotte's water infrastructure? Anybody know?
Well, 6% of the city's pipes were created and are at least 50 years old. Let me just say that 6% are at least 50% old. This Charlotte Water says most pipes were put in place around 1990 to 2000.
There's a major infrastructure bill that's passed the Senate in Washington. It's being held up in the House, being held hostage, so to speak, by progressive Democrats who want the Build Back Better plan to pass before they say yes to the infrastructure bill. And there are cities like Charlotte all across the country who desperately need money for infrastructure. Was the replacement of water pipes something that Charlotte had in mind if they get that money, or will it now be added to whatever list of priorities they may have already had for that money if it ever comes their way?
You know, I don't know if the infrastructure bill passed last year, they would have replaced this pipe specifically. Right. The city has a program that they are constantly evaluating pipes based on their age, type, repair history, and conflicts with other utilities and growth. And they use all those factors to determine whether or not a pipe needs to be replaced. If you've been to the Chick-fil-A or Harris Teeter in South End, you know that the city has water pipe replacement project undergoing right there on South Boulevard. So that's an example of how the city is kind of constantly looking for pipes to replace here. It's just this pipe burst before the city had the chance to fix it.
But this is another example.
This does put a focus, as you said, on Washington, and people always talk about infrastructure, but this country is full of aging infrastructure, whether you talk about pipes, bridges, and they really do need repair. And particularly Charlotte is growing so quickly, and there are so many questions in a fast growth place like Charlotte. Is the infrastructure keeping up with this as we have more and more people moving in? And really, you know, we're focusing on, can we service them? Can our water system service them? Can our transportation system service them? And so when we look at these other cities across the country, and you see in Michigan and so forth, where lead is seeping into the drinking water, and we say, oh, that's there. Something that happened like this makes people in Charlotte say, oh, okay, yeah, we need to really pay attention to this issue as well.
Infrastructure, whether you believe in big government or not, infrastructure is one of the things that only government is going to do. And that takes tax dollars, because as a city manager or a county manager in Mecklenburg County told me many thousands of times, Harry Jones, he said, taxes equal services. No taxes, no services. And we've been through these years and years and years of tax cuts, and we have this aging, crumbling infrastructure all over the country. This impacted a lot of great swaths of Charlotte. What was the impact? I know the airport did a ground stop. Why? Because they couldn't use the bathrooms. Harris Teeter closed the deli at the Park Road Shopping Center and the fish section because they didn't have any water. What was the deal? How many businesses were impacted by this, and for how long?
I don't think we'll actually know the true impact. We won't be able to put a dollar amount on the business lost, but certainly it was substantial for a lot of businesses who had to close down completely on Monday night. Several posted on social media that, you know, they were just taking the night off because they didn't have any water. Others, I heard anecdotally, had bought up all of the bottled water from the Plaza Midwood Harris Teeter and were serving it to customers as a way to stay open. So the damage was widespread. They handled it as quickly as they could. But I think that because this thing was felt so so strongly across many parts of the city, there was just a lot more attention on it. And this type of break was huge. But water, you know, disruptions in water do happen all the time in cities, not just Charlotte. So this was new for a lot of us. You know, boiling our water is not something that we are used to doing.
And that's why a lot of these places had to close or curtail operations. It wasn't that they didn't have water. It was that the city issued this boil water advisory. And for some locations, some businesses, that wasn't practical. But it took a long time, Katie, for that word to get out, that boil water instruction. I think you reported it took 4 hours. Why?
Well, and the other thing is when the word actually came out about the boil water advisory, it was still fairly unclear as to what you should do. It said that residents who are impacted, you know, with a temporary water loss or low water pressure can boil their water. So it seems like more of a suggestion than a directive. And it came after a delay, Angela Charles told us, because they had to evaluate exactly what was going on. They didn't want to issue something right away to freak everyone out, I think.
Well, here's exactly what she explained the delay.
I know that the need for information sometimes is faster than we can deliver it. There is a period of time when we are in isolation and assessment, and we are dealing with something here that is not, of the norm. Water systems have water main breaks, and that's a part of managing a dynamic system.
But Joe, you report that when the city of Rock Hill had a major break back in 2019, they issued a boil water advisory within an hour and sent out a reverse 911 message. The break occurred here at what, between 4 and 5:30, somewhere in that time frame on Monday. It was just before 6 that Charlotte Water reported the break. It wasn't until 9:30 p.m. when a spokesman told people to boil water, and it took till 1:30 in the morning for Charlotte Water to tweet their boil water advisory. This turned out not to have been dangerous, but it could have been, and Charlotte Water said that they could have done a better job. But that doesn't speak to the larger communication problem within the city. What's up with that? I mean, I get calls all the time from Charmec alerts. I didn't get the boil water alert. I did get the all clear from them.
The communication in this crisis was about as clear as the water inside Irwin Creek, where the pipe actually burst. It took nearly 2 hours. If they say that this happened around four, it took about 2 hours for them to let the public know that water was shooting out of Irwin Creek like it was Niagara Falls. And city council members were in the dark as well. This really didn't come to light until the owner of Seoul tweeted to me and said, "Hey, why doesn't my restaurant have running water right now?" And then more and more people were saying online that, "Hey, I'm having water issues in South End too." City council members, multiple of them, texted me asking what is going on right now with the water in our city. So it's not like the public was just in the dark. The elected officials were in the dark as well. And then I want to go back to what Katie said, because when that press release came out, it said that residents can boil water like we always can. But when I called the spokesperson, he clarified, no, this is a boil water advisory. So unless you follow me on Twitter, or if you watched our newscast, you really didn't know that you're supposed to be boiling water until 1:30 in the morning when everyone was sleeping.
They said
communication was terrible in this incident. City council members are not pleased with how this was handled. I've heard that people in the upper ranks of the city aren't happy either. So I would expect that this will be under review and we'll see changes made.
I think it's just official that Joe Bruno's Twitter is the official communication system for everything.
All things trolley and water. The boil water advisory was issued out of, quote, an abundance of caution, and later rescinded. We have water main breaks all the time, Katie. Why did they feel it was necessary to maybe have people boil water this time around?
It's my understanding that they were not clear whether or not there could have been some sort of contamination from the initial break of the line. Like perhaps something could have gotten in there, and they just didn't want to lead people astray and tell them to go ahead and drink water if it wasn't safe to do so. So there's obviously no harm in boiling your water. Obviously, it's much safer if you do that. So I think that they just wanted to be better safe than sorry in this situation.
Yeah, boil your water and throw out your onions. That was the word this week because of the Salmonella breakout among some onions being bought from Mexico. We have to take a break. We're coming back with more in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Ann Doss Helms from WFAE News, Joe Bruno from WSOC-TV, Katie Peralta-Soloff from Axios Charlotte, and Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call. Mary, the Observer reported that if you were to line up all of Charlotte water and wastewater pipes, they would stretch from the Queen City to the Philippines with room to spare. That's a lot of pipe. And they also report that Charlotte Water, which happens to be the largest utility in the Carolinas, has been in operation since 1889. I don't know if there are any pipes or infrastructure that date back to 1889, but it could be, because that's the case in some cities around America, which brings us back to this infrastructure package in Washington. Is there enough money in that package to even make a dent if it passes in all the needs of all the cities around America?
Well, they're negotiating parts of it, because the hard infrastructure bill, which they use to say traditional things like pipes and like bridges, there was a bipartisan agreement, but that was held up because they have this reconciliation bill that has more money in it for what is called so-called human infrastructure. And they're negotiating that down. And you do have the different factions saying, we want the whole package. And Republicans are pretty much saying, well, let the Democrats argue this out, because they would rather nothing be done, in a sense, because we have the 2022 elections coming up, but they're going to run on what, how much of the Biden agenda can be passed and how much isn't passed. So, you know, they're negotiating, but everybody has a different interest group. But I think there is general agreement that in this bipartisan bill, there is so much needed, because whether you're a red state or a blue state, you can see these water systems failing and water supply being affected. You can see these bridges crumbling. So as far as, is there enough money in it? Well, we've neglected them for so long. We'll see. And there's an argument over how everything will be paid for, taxes, et cetera. So the answer to that is, it's anybody's guess now.
It's anybody's guess.
We will get some hard infrastructure money for sure. And we'll see if they will let them vote on that bipartisan package. But there'll be other things in the other reconciliation bill, from child care to climate change legislation. And they're negotiating on that piece of it. Unfortunately, like I said, we had Bettenheimer, Michigan, who now their water supply, they said, was worse than Flint. We see these things popping up all over the country. And Charlotte, I think, thought it was immune to it. But now we see, okay, yeah, we have these problems as well, when people are talking about you might have to boil your water to brush your teeth. So I think we'll have bipartisan support from Republicans and Democrats in North Carolina.
This could have been dangerous, as I said, but it wasn't this time around. Who knows what might happen with something else later on down the road. But this kind of elicited a couple of jokes, even from the mayor. I know this is serious, and that the city council is not happy about this, and they'll be taking this up in future investigations, I suppose. But at Monday's city council meeting, Mayor Vialile said, I've never seen anything get that high in Charlotte, referring, of course, to the geyser, which led the alternative publication Queen City Nerve to joke that she must have missed last week's concert by Dead & Company, which are former members of the Grateful Dead who were in town playing. So I guess, you know, we've been looking for a water feature or a tourist attraction in Charlotte, so maybe a permanent geyser is the answer to our dreams here. Who knows? All right, moving on. Politicians and officials at all levels of state government and local government are busy drawing new election maps to comply with the results of the 2020 census. So let's start at the state level. The Republican-controlled legislature is faced with drawing maps for their own districts, as well as for congressional maps. And North Carolina, of course, is getting a 14th congressional district, a new district, which will require even more map drawing, I suppose. So far, these maps that we've seen indicate the GOP is considering maps that would give their party a sizable advantage in future election. Is what we're seeing, and nothing's been decided yet, but is what we're seeing any more egregious than the maps that resulted on all those lawsuits that we have talked about for years on this program and others?
Some of them are, because what you see is attempts to break up like Mecklenburg County and cities, which are traditionally, say, vote Democratic, breaking them up in two, in three, in four pieces. And we've seen that in the past. We saw Asheville for a while had the city broken up. So a so-called progressive city was represented by two of the most conservative House members in Congress. So I think you will expect more lawsuits, because actually, when you look at the voting in the state, it's kind of split. We're kind of a purple state, But it was 10-3. After the lawsuits now, it's 8-5 for Republicans. And some of these maps that they are putting out now, they're drawing to actually, you can draw it in a sense that they can have almost all of the seats. So I think you'll see a lot more lawsuits. And we'll see when the public starts talking about it, because there'll be a lot of public input. Yeah.
And the maps we've seen, I think, if I'm right about this, give the GOP an 11-3 or a 10-4 advantage, depending upon which map you're looking at. So they're moving the needle back in the direction that the courts moved it away from, I suppose, that the argument could be made there. As an aside, it should be noted that in the 2020 election, North Carolina voters were almost evenly split between the two major parties, with only a slight edge going toward Republicans, despite gerrymandering and things like that. Trump won that race here in North Carolina, 49.9% of the vote to President Biden's 48.6. So it was pretty close. Is this another example, Mary, of what we're witnessing happening around the country, where the minority is controlling the majority because of the Electoral College and the number of senators in states that that trend red, even though there's no people living in those states, et cetera? Are we contributing to that?
Well, the system has set up to favor the more rural, sparsely populated states. When you say that Wyoming has the same amount of senators as, say, California, in spite of the fact that I think Wyoming has fewer than 1 million people and California has, 50 million plus. But you also see the courts, because the Supreme Court, if we do go to the courts, they look askance at racial gerrymandering, but say partisan gerrymandering is acceptable. And yeah, so I think they feel they have a good chance. But yes, you've seen now that a lot of the states are having these laws to tamp down and restrict the votes of people of, that's what they would say, people of color, young people, disabled, and that does skew it. And I think North Carolina is ground zero. It's a diverse state. It's pretty much split. And if it looks like the Republicans are going to put the thumb on the scale more for themselves, and the fact that the governor, the Democratic governor, can't weigh in, I think you will see a lot of lawsuits, a lot of protests. But you're right, it is a national trend. You see, in Texas, they're getting two more seats in the House, primarily because of people of color, Hispanics, Blacks, Asians moving in, but the state legislature there, which also has control, Republicans who have control of redistricting, are skewing it to actually reduce the effect and the power of those voters. So yes, Mike, this is a national trend and it's gonna get pretty ugly.
Katie, I believe you have a Zoom hand raised. Did you want to chime in on this, or am I just imagining? Is that just a cursor thing sitting on your screen?
Just a cursor thing sitting on my screen. Thank you, though.
You're welcome.
Mary has it covered.
Moving closer to home, Charlotte City Council held a public hearing on Monday night about their new election maps. They were looking for input, and they got it, especially from residents of the African-American Hidden Valley neighborhood, one of the largest neighborhoods in the city. They faced the prospect of being moved into a new district, and many of those who showed up to the meeting wanted no part of that. There are three maps, A, B, and C. We're told that council is leaning toward either B or C, but Hidden Valley resident Charlene Henderson urged the council to reconsider.
Map A is the only map that protects and preserves Hidden Valley all-Black voting record. Map A is the only map that guarantees the federally protected constitutional right to vote with racial fairness.
And maps B and C would shift two Hidden Valley precincts from District 4 into District 1, which has more white voters. Cedric Dean has a big problem with that.
District 1 has voted for all white candidates. District 4 has voted for all Black candidates. We could never be a community of interest with District 1. Thank you.
Talk about this. This is difficult to talk about, but talk about it.
The first thing, there is a fourth map. It's called B1. And that is the map that all indications are Charlotte City Council will pass, because the redistricting committee unanimously voted to recommend it to full council. The only difference between B and B1 are two precincts near Central Avenue that are shifted to D5 from D1 because they wanted all of Eastland's parcels to be together. But Hidden Valley would go to D1 and B1 as well. The request for Map A was not received with much interest because there's a fear that Map A will be lopsided again in just a few years. That was kind of created as a way to show how City Council could do the bare minimum and remain constitutionally compliant. But the way our population has been growing, council members and the consultant who created the maps feel like those districts could be out of whack in a short amount of time. So that's why A wasn't recommended. Councilman Malcolm Graham's point to the Hidden Valley residents is that District 1 is going to be an open seat because Larkin Eggleston is running at large, and a savvy candidate could do well in District 1. So their fears of not having adequate representation could be unfounded if they apply this energy and run for that seat in that new district.
And the consultant drawing the maps is Mac McCarley. He used to be a city attorney, and he says there would be some advantages to shifting Hidden Valley or parts of it into District 1. It would increase, he says, the number of Black voters in that district in District 1 from 26% to 33%. And he said that would make it easier for a Black candidate to win in District 1. But what would it do to District 4? Anything? Nothing?
Nothing too major. I believe there are some precincts that shift from District 2 into District 4, so the demographics of District 4 remain largely the same.
Citing the Voting Rights Act of 1965, residents said the move would, quote, illegally dampen their voting rights. And Charles Robinson, who is vice president of the Hidden Valley Community Association, told council, if you don't listen to the law, we're going to take you to court. So we're just getting started here. Stay tuned. On the other hand, you were at the county commission meeting, Joe, where commissioners appeared leery of making changes to their map. Is that because the district is the commission is entirely comprised of Democrats and they want to keep it that way?
You know, I was a little surprised because when the maps were introduced, commissioners seemed open to the drastic change map, option C, that would shift districts pretty radically, like bringing parts of Plaza Midwood into District 5, which is currently just South Charlotte, and making Susan Rodriguez McDowell's district just only Ballantyne Pineville area, and sending Matthews Mint Hill out to District 3 for Mark Jarrell. But commissioners appear to be going for that minimal change strategy. Only like one precinct from Steel Creek District 2 would shift over to District 5 into Laura Myers district. So they really aren't making many drastic changes. And I will say that the districts, the Mecklenburg County districts, are pretty competitive. There are three toss-up seats. I know Democrats have won the last two elections, but a savvy Republican candidate can win in D1, D6, and D5.
Yeah. That's Precinct 98 that you're talking about, that they want to shift out of District 2 and put in District 5. That's a tiny, tiny geographic area. What are they hoping to achieve? Is this about population balance? Because I know they want the districts to be relatively the same size in terms of the number of people. Or is there something else they're trying to achieve here with that?
No, you're right. It's really just making sure all the districts are relatively the same size.
And Charlotte-Mecklenburg School Board has just begun the process of redrawing their districts. They're a little behind the city and county in this effort. You say that their process is not focused on partisan politics, but on keeping communities intact and keeping incumbents in their current districts. Are they doing the map drawing themselves, or have they hired somebody to do it for them?
What the school board came up with criteria and handed it off to a handful of staff, which is using software. And the staff came back, they made a big point of saying, we present this at the school board meeting, the board members have not seen it until now, here it is. So they came out with three versions also, all of which are pretty dramatically different from what exists and from each other. I mean, there are just whole chunks of the county moving to different districts. So, and what they're doing now is this week they've been taking that to the public. They will have an actual public hearing on Tuesday, and then the school board will go back and say, well, do we like any of these three, or, you know, what do we do with this? But they they were asking about, you know, what was the driving factor here? And it was the make sure that incumbents don't have to don't put any two incumbents into one district with the new map. And Charlie Jeter, who was the person that was presenting it, said that was our biggest challenge because we have four incumbents from District 2, 3, 4, and 5, and they all live pretty close to the center city. So you're having to really kind of work around that. And we'll see what the public reaction is. I think one big thing may be District 6 has pretty consistently, for as long as I've been covering this, represented kind of that south, southeast suburban stretch, you know, Mint Hill, Matthews, Pineville, the kind of the Ballantyne area. The school board representative has tended to be a pretty strong suburban spokesperson, and 6 is broken up in any scenario. A couple of them pick up the southwestern tip, which has been, the southwestern tip has been a lot of growth. So right now, District 2, which is west, southwest, is way overpopulated. So it's going somewhere else. And District 6 is going to have some combination of suburbs in the southwest Charlotte. So we shall see what people think about
that.
So
the school board is also trying to draw districts that are equal in terms of the number of people in them. Is that the case?
But yeah, and I believe that's required by law. And I'm not quite sure how the county is doing it without major change. One question that keeps coming up is, why doesn't the school board just sit back and do whatever the county does? It's the same county, you know, it's the same number of districts. Charlie Jeter says it's because of the incumbents, that all of the county maps double bunk at least two incumbents. And the school board has said that's one of our criteria, is don't double us up. So, and I don't know if that's traditional. I know there's always some awareness of where incumbents will land, but they would have to go back and say, we change our criteria if they are willing to put some of these folks into the same new district.
We do this every. I have 30 seconds. We do this every 10 years, Mary, and I'm wondering if we should just make a national law that says we should take this out of the hands of politicians, because these exercises seem to be exercises in job preservation. I have 20 seconds. Comment.
Independent commissions are popular in some areas, which takes it out of politics, but the politicians with control don't want to do that.
Of course not.
Look in Washington. They may be able to change who runs Congress by just redistricting alone. So it's power.
When we come back, we'll get a COVID update and talk about school staffing shortages. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on the Local News Roundup. I'm Mike Collins on WFAE with Ann Doss Helms, Joe Bruno from WSOC, Katie Peralta Soloff from Axios, Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call, and of course from WFAE News, our education reporter. And that's why we're going to talk about COVID cases coming down, but vaccines for 5 to 11-year-olds on the horizon, which we'll talk about in a moment. But right now, schools are dealing with staffing shortages, and you say teachers are quitting in staggering numbers at CMS. Why?
Well, you know, they have a form that they fill out that says why you're quitting, and needless to say, COVID is not on that. So you're just getting things like, you know, to be with family or that type of thing. But their HR person says clearly it's related to this. And in the first few weeks of 2019, which was the last pre-pandemic year, they processed 169 resignations and retirements. And then in 2020, when there was all the going remote and all that stress, it went up to 300. This year, it's been 500 and counting. And
so is it reaction because they have to get a shot, or because they have to wear a mask, or is it because they're afraid that the kids aren't vaccinated and they're not wearing masks? What is it?
I think it is just a pileup of stresses that, you know, everything that they've been asked to do that was extra. Last year was kind of like running a marathon, and then a lot of them came back to do summer school. And there was kind of this period in the summer where it looked like, okay, we're bringing the kids back, cases are down, vaccines are here, it's going to be back to normal. And then we got Delta, and then we got resistance to vaccines, and we've gotten, you know, every labor market has been disrupted.
Right.
So it's not unique to schools, but when you start to have teachers disappear and you can't get subs because a lot of them are retirement age and are worried about exposure to COVID, you know, even if everybody wanted to get vaccinated, a lot of the kids cannot be vaccinated. So you've got, you know, you go in and you've got your day's work, and then you got to pick up another class, or you have extra kids sent to your class.
So Carrie Tolbert, who's speaking of teachers taking on extra roles, Carrie Tolbert is the principal of Iredell-Statesville's Oakwood Middle School. She says she's never had So few candidates apply for open teacher positions, and she, the principal, has been filling in as a bus driver because of staff shortages.
Right now, what educators are being asked to do is do normal educational things in a very abnormal world.
She is also on the board of the North Carolina Principals and Assistant Principals Association. That group calls staff shortages the biggest issue facing schools this year, and that schools are in triage mode. What is that? That's serious. What does that mean in terms of schools?
Triage. Well, it just means that every day you're going in and figuring out what you have to do that day to get things done, whether that's, you know, throwing somebody into a lunch line or a bus driver's position, whether that's, you know, again, I talked to a teacher at North MEC who was talking about crowding lots of kids into a small classroom, which is obviously not ideal for COVID control. And, you know, and on top of all this, everybody I've talked to at a school has said behavior is worse this year. And, you know, that's apparently because everybody spent so long at home and, you know, instead of coming in as a freshman and learning the rules and now you're a 10th grader, you're coming in as a 10th grader and there's, you know, there's fights, there's disruption. So, I mean, it makes me anxious to talk to educators to think about what they're going through.
Everybody's
there's
behavior.
Also,
go ahead.
I was going to say the Great Resignation touches virtually every industry in the country, and education is certainly not immune to this. And part of the like ongoing trends here include the fact that people are reexamining what they want in an employer and what they're willing to sacrifice in order to take a full-time job. I remember when we did sort of an evaluation of the parental leave policies at some of Charlotte's biggest employers, it's abysmal at CMS. So if you have all of these choices for open jobs, of which there are tons right now, there are tons of open jobs, it's a really good time to be a job seeker, you have your pick of the litter. So if you feel used and abused and underpaid and like you have crappy benefits, obviously you're going to look for something else. And it's a time when employers are really upping the ante, or at least saying that they're going to, or trying to up the ante in terms of what they offer to employees in terms of higher pay, better benefits, certain perks. And I'm not sure if schools are keeping up with that as they should be.
And behavior, bad behavior seems to be happening at all levels of society, and certainly among adults. Just go to a school board meeting and watch the adults in action around the country. And several educators shared with you, Anne, a comment that sounds both like a friendly suggestion and a plea. They say, stop letting political anger flow into the classrooms. I doubt if anybody's listening. What should be good news to everybody out there may turn into be our next controversy, and that is the facts that vaccines are on the horizon for students, for kids 5 to 11. The Biden administration has purchased 65 million pediatric doses of the vaccine. That's enough to vaccinate the estimated 28 million children in that age group, the entire group. Mecklenburg County is set to get a mere 13,500 doses in the first shipment. They're waiting for FDA approval for the Pfizer shot. Why so few doses, Joe, and when is that anticipated to begin?
That actually is the most amount of doses allocated to a county or healthcare provider in North Carolina. Then the county will take those 13,500 doses and dole them out to pharmacies and medical providers. Obviously, the places that you think of, like StarMed, will have them. So parents should know that they're going to be widely available. I think people are looking at hopefully November, early November, to start these pediatric vaccinations. We just got the Pfizer data that shows they are effective, and health officials are already getting out the message that they are safe and effective. They work, and they're encouraging parents to consider getting their children 5 to 11 vaccinated.
Mecklenburg County alone has 100,000 children who fall into that age grouping. 13,500 doses seems woefully insufficient. But Dr. Raynard Washington, the deputy health director for Mecklenburg County, told the county commission he's optimistic they'll be able to vaccinate everyone in short order.
We believe that we'll have adequate supply for everyone within the first couple of weeks. However, of course, we will not be able to vaccinate 100,000 people in the first couple of weeks, but we certainly are children. But we certainly are geared up to vaccinate as quickly as possible.
Just as a sidebar, in Mecklenburg County in the last 2 weeks, 14.3% of new COVID-19 cases have been in children, 9 and younger. 9.5% in kids 10 to 14. And WSOC-TV spoke with one parent who said she believed these vaccines would, quote, make life easier for the parents just knowing that they'll be able to send their kids to school without having to worry about their safety. But one would presume there will be a large group of parents adamantly opposed to getting their kids vaccinated. Will these vaccines be mandatory or optional?
As of now, they're not mandatory. There is a state health commission that can mandate them in the future, or the legislature could do that. Don't think the legislature will, excuse me. Glad I can talk this morning. You know, I do think there's going to have to be a strong public messaging campaign on this, because while there is a significant amount of COVID-19 cases in this age range, we're still not seeing hospitalizations. So I think parents will have to be convinced of the benefit to getting their children 5 to 11 vaccinated.
Moving on, several years ago, Charlotte Pipe and Foundry announced that they would be vacating that piece of land over there on off of Moorhead Street near I-77. They've been there for 100 years, and they plan to relocate. They've already begun building their new facility. I think it's in Stanley County. So immediately, everyone assumed that that land would be gobbled up by David Tepper and company for a new stadium for the Panthers. But at a city council meeting this week, they held a rezoning meeting, and it appeared other plans for that land have emerged. What are they talking about now? Joe.
Sorry, Katie was on mute. Okay. She was saying something.
Oh, I'm sorry. Katie, go ahead. You're on mute, Katie. Take yourself off mute.
You'd think I would have learned by now. What they looked at Monday evening was, I believe, fairly expected, like a mixed use of different types of entertainment, retail, stadium use as a possibility at the site, which is a pretty massive piece of property so close to the city center. It's been widely speculated that Tepper would want to gobble that up because Bank of America Stadium is one of the oldest stadiums in the NFL, and there are very few options for that type of facility in an urban city center like he wants to keep the Panthers playing in. But I think that there are still some reservations among city council about whether, you know, what the future of this site looks like. I think that one thing will be really interesting to find out. I don't know like how we'll find this out, but like the remediation on the site, there was, I don't know if it's considered like a brownfield or anything, but there is a lot of industrial use going on this property that will have to be addressed and cleaned up in the years to come.
Joe?
Yeah, that's a pretty wide ranging rezoning category that Charlotte Pipe is seeking to rezone this land from industrial to. So a stadium will be a permitted use, but you know, if David Tepper's slow, another developer could come in and put apartment complexes all around. And I think one concern the city has is they approve this rezoning and they lose their negotiating and bargaining power later down the line, so they wouldn't be able to ask for a park included or benefits for the public.
Why would they even consider approving this rezoning before the Unified Development Ordinance is approved and in operation? This is a big tract of land, and that would, it would seem to me, those two would intersect.
Yeah, I think that's something council members are asking themselves. The advantage here is for Charlotte Pipe because it makes the land a lot more desirable and they can get a lot more money for the land if it's not for sale as an industrial piece of property.
Okay. Schools were hoping that this would be a rebuilding year, Ann, but it isn't turning out that way. Something else is happening other than teacher shortages. The post-remote attendance rebound at CMS in particular did not happen. What does that mean?
Well, you'll recall last year, almost every school district in North Carolina and across the country lost students as a lot of kindergartners stayed home. People sought other options. You know, this whole remote hybrid stuff kind of threw people off. And the idea was, well, we think people are going to come back this year. The statewide numbers maybe are going to be posted today, so we don't have that context. But CMS thought they were going to get a significant number of students back, and it's virtually flat. And they've now posted the diversity numbers. And what we see is that if it were not for Hispanic students, it wouldn't even be flat. It would have kept going down. That is the only group of students that has rebounded to a little above pre-pandemic levels. Black and Asian students are down a little bit, and white enrollment is down significantly over the last 2 years.
You say that white students, exactly, they make up only 25% of the student population. What does that say about the future of public education?
Well, you know, and this is difficult to talk about because you don't want to make it sound like, ooh, the best thing for any school is white kids. But traditionally, when you see white enrollment fall very low in a community, when a school system becomes perceived as virtually all minority, political support resources become harder to marshal for that. And there's been talk since I started covering this beat in 2002, when they went to the new combination of choice and neighborhood-based assignments, about tipping points. You know, when do you hit a tipping point at which not just white families, but families of all colors who have choices perceive public schools as not being an option? And there are now more schools that are less than 10% white, which is typically considered hyper-segregated. Again, not surprising when 25% is the overall number. Larger numbers of Black and Hispanic students, larger proportions of Black and Hispanic students are in these schools that are virtually all non-white. There are fewer majority white schools. There are still a significant number of them, but there are fewer, and white students are less likely to be in them now.
3 minutes left, 2.5 minutes left, I guess. And so we've hit the lightning round here. Yesterday, the Charlotte Convention Center, which is relatively new, started a renovation project in 2019 to create additional space. And yesterday, Katie, Joe, you were both there. What were they doing? Cutting the ribbon on the new space?
Very much a ceremonial event to kind of usher in a new era of what they think will be hopefully more and larger conventions, sort of the field of dreams of convention centers here. They're hoping that in a post-COVID world, this sexy new facility with a, you know, crosswalk over Stonewall and more breakout meeting space and a new HVAC system will attract the type of business conventions that'll help kind of revitalize uptown Charlotte and sort of, again, usher us into this age of being a world-class city.
And the governor, Joe, was in town yesterday, specifically in Ballantyne at the Leaf Spring School Daycare Center to talk about child care stabilization grants. You were the pool reporter for that, Joe. What did he announce?
Well, there is a bunch of money available for private daycares and child care facilities to assist with teacher retention, bonuses, and other resources that they need. There is a child care workforce crisis right now, so this is great money that these centers can apply for and apply and use for their needs.
I just want to say that I have a smoke alarm going off in the house right now. It's been beeping for hours, and so now it's decided it's going to tell me to do something. Don't have time for that. We have to move on. Town elections are going on in Cornelius, Davidson, Huntersville, Matthews, Mint Hill, Pineville, and Stallings. Very low voter turnout so far. Is that because most of the mayors are running unopposed, or is there something else at work here? Very quickly, Joe.
It's because the only voting location for a week was in Midtown. So what's motivating someone from Cornelius to come down? I'm happy to report that voting surged by 33,150%. We went from 2 voters to a little more than 600.
Wow. In a very unusual move, the Hornets honored the late Rick Bunnell, former sports columnist for the Charlotte Observer, on their opening game of the season with a $10,000 scholarship for a North Carolina journalism student, and they even named the staff and media entrance after Rick Bunnell. So congratulations to him. That's all the time we have. Ann Doss Helms from WFAE News, Joe Bruno from WSOC-TV, Katie Peralta Soloff from Axios Charlotte, and Mary C. Curtis from Roll Call and the host of their Equal Time podcast. Thank you all for the hour. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.